Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. A new report from the Boston Foundation warns that growing economic inequality remains one of the biggest threats to the region's long-term prosperity. And here are some numbers.
In 2010, Boston's richest 20% earned more than half of the region's income. And the poorest 20% made just over 2% of that income.
So that income disparity means the vast majority of workers remain vulnerable to economic downturns. It also means that the economic recovery is leaving many people behind.
But the report also includes some good news. It says Greater Boston has ridden out the recession much better than most of the nation. Unemployment has dropped a full point over the last year thanks to a thriving innovation economy with well-paying jobs in finance, high-tech, and biotech.
But what has to happen in order to spread that good fortune and wealth more evenly across the entire socioeconomic landscape? That's the question at the heart of the report called City of Ideas, Reinventing Boston's Innovation Economy. Charlotte Kahn is the author. She's director of the Indicators Project at the Boston Foundation, and she joins us now. And Charlotte Kahn, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you so much.
Good to have you. Also with us is Joan Fitzgerald. She's director of the Law and Public Policy Program at Northeastern University. She's also the author of Emerald Cities, Urban Sustainability and Economic Development. Thanks for joining us, Joan.
Thanks for having me.
Charlotte Kahn, let me start with you. I read the report sort of as good news, bad news study. Boston is doing better than most of the country, but we face big challenges if we want to sustain that progress. Let's start with the good news. What's working in terms of the local economy?
Boston really is one of the most fortunate places, we could say, on Earth in terms of its innovative capacity. We have an incredible constellation of institutions of higher education. We've been attracting talent for many, many years, and talented people have been creating great new ideas, spinning them out, new companies. We've seen a lot of transitions from one major innovation sector to another over the last few decades, and we've managed to skate along extremely well, avoiding a lot of the downturns that have hit the Rust Belt and other parts of the country.
And yet, even with the advantages of a sort of thriving innovation economy, many people are being left behind, according to this report, right?
Yes. It's not a completely new phenomenon, and it's certainly not unique to Boston. This is something that's been happening in the nation as a whole for the last 30 years. We've seen productivity increase, mm-hmm. Through automation, outsourcing of industrial jobs, and essentially stagnant wages for a long time, while some basic costs have been going up dramatically. Healthcare, housing. So, Boston is not different from the rest of the country. What makes us perhaps unique is the upside that we've been attracting more and more wealthy people, higher educated people. One wonderful thing is that we've been retaining well-educated young people here. But at the same time, as we move sort of ahead on the one hand, we're leaving others behind. And in Boston, that means deepening poverty in Roxbury, Dorchester, Mattapan, among young people, particularly young people of color, low-income households, and our economy has not been able to lift them in sufficient measure.
So we want to talk about how to do that, how Boston can do that. But let me ask you another question that's identified in the study, and this is a big challenge, and it was actually a challenge that was identified by Governor Patrick in his State of the State speech last January. Employers in this state, in the city, have literally, in the region, have tens of thousands of unfilled jobs. There are tens of thousands of unemployed in need of work. But you identify what you call a skills mismatch, right? Can you describe
Yes.
that?
In our report, we talk about approximately 71,000 unfilled jobs across the state, and that number has been estimated now to be about 120,000 by the governor's office of jobs that are going unfilled. Now, a high percentage of those are low-skilled jobs. Some are extremely high-skilled jobs. What I think many people are very interested in is this large number of jobs in the middle that many people could access if they had a bit more training or, you know, if our community college system were working better, if we could connect people through even personal networks to job opportunities around the state. So it's important to understand that we do have 120,000 unfilled jobs. That is a big number. At the same time, if every one of those jobs were filled by a currently unemployed person, we would have another 120,000 unemployed people remaining. So our challenge is twofold. One
right,
is to match
skills mismatch. It's also
as well as job creation. We need to tackle this on both tracks.
Now, Joan Fitzgerald, let me talk to you. You were at the Fed this morning when mm-hmm. this report was presented. What struck you most about it? What was sort of your top line takeaway?
I think that we're doing so well now, but looking ahead into the future and looking at the disparities in education, particularly for African Americans and Hispanics, that we're wasting a lot of human capital that we're going to need down the line in a number of different areas. And I think we're starting to address that. One example is the huge disparities in the healthcare workforce that your report pointed out. The mayor has been working on this. There have been a number of initiatives on diversity in the healthcare workforce. And we evaluated one at Northeastern that was trying to recruit high school students for these mid-level careers in healthcare, mm-hmm. Various kinds of technicians in hospitals, RNs that go to community colleges. And one of the things we found was that it's too late to start in high school, that the students did not have the science and mathematics skills that they needed to even go into a community college program. And so one of the things I think we realize is you have to go right back to the K-12 system. And Massachusetts does have a STEM, the Science, Technology, Engineering, and Mathematics initiative ongoing to try to help with that. So that's one thing that I saw. I think in another area where we tend to think that Massachusetts doesn't need to worry about manufacturing, but we found out there's, 260,000 people employed in manufacturing, and one of the things the state is doing is, for example, looking at clean technology and what are the clean technologies of the future, what are the parts that go into making those, can we create a supply chain of manufacturing jobs. So I think both at the state and city level, we are seeing initiatives to try to create opportunities for educating people in those middle tier jobs.
So that's really one of the big challenges here. Listeners, we're talking about a new report from the Boston Foundation that contrasts the city's relatively healthy economy with a troubling and growing income gap, rising health care costs, and a serious skills mismatch, all of which could threaten future economic growth. So what's your take on the state of the city's economy and what has to happen to spread the wealth more evenly? More investment in education? More job training? What do you see in your own personal economy? Give us a call at 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at Radio Boston. Charlotte Kahn, let me come back to you. You know, lots of talk about the challenge in this report of the growing economic disparity, which a big challenge outlined in this report. And as you suggest, this has been a problem for a while. But how do you characterize it and what has to be done about it? Or how best to confront it, I guess, is what I'd like to ask.
Well, I think one of the things that we point out in the report is that low-income people are actually bearing a disproportionate fiscal burden even for the state budget. In other words, low-income people are paying a higher percentage of their income in all state and local taxes than very high-income people. Low-income people, the lowest income, 20%, about 10% of their income, the highest, you know, 1%, around 6% of their income in all state and local taxes. In this kind of environment, again, with rising health care costs, rising housing costs, especially rentals, and now rising T fares, we cannot afford to be resting our fiscal health on low-income people. That's, in a sense, one of the things that's happening. We've also, in our report, looked at the lottery and how low-income people are actually spending quite a greater percentage of their income, about 3% overall, on lottery tickets that then flow across the state in the form of unrestricted state local aid. So I would say one thing is that we really do need to take a look at the revenue structure of the Commonwealth. We think of ourselves as a progressive state. I don't think that this is something that we're talking about very much in terms of the public dialogue.
So you're talking about making the system of taxation more progressive, for example?
Taxation, yes, all kinds of revenues. And I think that, you know, as we talk about jobs, we need to look at how much we're spending and perhaps even wasting, for example, on health care. The Associated Industries of Massachusetts had a blog post yesterday that referenced the fact that many experts have calculated that we're probably wasting about a third of our healthcare dollars or our healthcare spending. In Massachusetts, that quote unquote unnecessary spending is probably about $21 billion a year.
You know, when it comes to healthcare, your report warns that like the rest of the nation, this city and state could really be crushed by these healthcare costs. And you come up with a figure that I found staggering. Per capita healthcare expenditures will reach almost $18,000 per citizen per year by 2020.
By 2020. Now, that is not our calculation. That's the RAND Corporation, and it's backed up by the Massachusetts Department of Public Health. Now, that's almost double what we're spending today, which is about $10,000 per capita. And if we're wasting or unnecessarily spending about a third of that, that creates an enormous opportunity cost in terms of what we're not spending on education, housing, transit. You know, that figure, we actually had a chart today, and we call it sort of the tower and the pancake. You see this enormous bar chart representing what we're misspending in healthcare, and then this tiny little line that you can barely see, that is the MBTA deficit. So
a drop in the bucket from what we're overspending on healthcare could take care of the MBTA just
yes,
like that.
It's so in this state and in this economy and in this city, our problem is not that we don't have the resources to do what needs to be done. Our challenge is really one of political will, of, you know, getting together, coming up with solutions. We have incredible innovative capacity within this region, probably, you know, more than anywhere else on earth. So we should just assume that we can solve any problem that we have. So the fact that, you know, we're not even educating all third graders in the Commonwealth to be able to read at the third grade level is really almost the threshold for what we might consider the opportunity for income equality in the future.
Well, Joan Fitzgerald, speaking of innovation and opportunities, your book, Emerald Cities, looks at green economic development, which, among other things, can create well-paying green jobs and things like construction, manufacturing, new technology sectors. Is Massachusetts doing enough to promote that?
Absolutely. Massachusetts is a leader with the Green Communities Act of 2008 and other initiatives recognized as being behind only California in its climate change and green technology. It is only behind California in venture capital spending on clean technology. And at the city level, Boston is also a leader. And one of the things that was mentioned today in the Innovation District will soon be home to the Fraunhofer Institute, which is Europe's. This is located in Freiburg, Germany, and now in Cambridge, and it will be in Boston. It's kind of what helped jumpstart Germany on clean technology to be a leading exporter by helping companies commercialize new products. And so that's happening in the innovation district here. And I think the reason we're poised to become a leader in clean technology is that we have strong policy both at the state and at the city level, and not just in Boston, many other cities throughout the Commonwealth.
So some good news there. I want to bring someone else into the conversation. Noah Berger is president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center, and he joins us now on the line from Boston. Hi, Noah.
Hello.
So we were talking about a report that raises fresh concerns about income disparity in the state. This, of course, is an issue that you folks there have been tracking. First off, what does income inequality do to the state's economy?
Yeah, I think, first of all, the report is very important in a number of ways, but the attention it draws to income inequality, I think, is also particularly important. And one of the problems with inequality, and it goes to a solution, is that we've seen over the last 30 years a big divergence in wages. That is, folks at the low levels, particularly people with less education, have seen their wages pretty much stagnant. At the higher level, wages have gone up fairly significantly. One piece of good news is that folks in the middle have actually done better in Massachusetts than in most other states. They haven't done as well as they had during the prior 30 years, but median income growth in Massachusetts has been much stronger than much of the country. And a big part of the reason for that is education. We have a better educated workforce than any other state in the country. About 44% of our labor force has a four-year college degree, and that helps drive our economy. It makes us a very attractive place for a lot of employers, and it's a major part of the reason why incomes have grown, why we do have significant resources here. But if 44% of the population has a four-year degree, that means the majority of the workforce doesn't. In fact, over 30% has only a high school degree or less. And one of the keys to addressing inequality is making sure that those folks who don't yet have the education and skills needed for the kinds of jobs that do pay a living wage today get that quality of education, so that kids growing up in Boston or Lawrence or Holyoke are able to get the quality of education that you need to be able to, you know, do well in high school, get into college, and do well in college. And
so Noah, is it education more than anything that's driving and widening that income gap, in your view?
I would say there are several things. Education is one of them. A second one is the minimum wage, honestly. That if you turn back to 1968, the minimum wage in today's dollars was about $10.50. A minimum wage worker working full-time then made about $21,000 a year in current dollars. Today, a minimum wage worker makes about $16,000 a year working full-time, $5,000 less than in the late 1960s. That, if you were to restore the minimum wage just to what it had been back then, that would lift the wages of about one in five workers in the economy. There's about the bottom 20% in terms of wages are affected by minimum wage increases, and that would do a significant amount to pull up the bottom and help those folks who have the lowest wage jobs, but yet in many cases work full time and are often trying to support a family. So the wages disparity has been a significant part of the problem, and simply raising the minimum wage would be a very effective way to address that. Education, I think, is a second important piece. And then connected to education is how we pay for this. And at the same time that we've seen pre-tax wage inequality grow dramatically, we've also seen a tax system become less equitable. So there have been significant tax cuts both at the state level and at the federal level that have primarily benefited the highest income folks in the state. So if we're looking for a way to pay for making those investments that will help low-income kids in our cities and in our, you know, suburbs and rural areas to be able to have the educational opportunity that some of their higher-income counterparts have, I think we have to be serious about looking at the revenue side of the equation, too, and saying maybe some of that, you know, we did about $2.5 billion of tax cuts in the last 15 years, which has really reduced both the state's ability to meet those needs, and it has to some degree exacerbated some of the inequality.
Noah Berger, thanks a lot. I know you've got a meeting to get back to, so we want to thank you for jumping in and giving us a couple of ideas to chew on. Thanks very much.
Great. Well, thank you very much, and thank you for the report.
That's Noah Berger, president of the Massachusetts Budget and Policy Center. So, Charlotte Kahn, a couple of things which seem to dovetail pretty well with some of the things that were in the report. Minimum wage, education, rethinking some of the revenue systems in this country around taxes and so forth. Did that make sense to you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
again, we are a wealthy state. We are a well-educated state, and this region in particular has unparalleled innovative capacity. We need to really begin to, we believe, in terms of creating new jobs, look at the challenges that we have, from how to educate all children to high global standards, how to create an affordable, high-quality healthcare system that actually makes us healthy, how to get an economy that is truly a low-carbon economy that really begins to shift in the direction that we must go in the 21st century, that can reduce our energy consumption. We can do all of that if we really expand the notion of innovation to include real-world problems and all people as potential innovators. In other words, we should be asking young people in this, you know, who are not doing well right now, who are kids who are at risk of failing in our current educational system, what do they think we should be doing? Let's start to treat them
as innovators.
So
really opening up a sort of civic dialogue, it sounds like you're talking about.
Well, to really expand the concept of innovator and innovation to include those people who are actually experiencing the problems that we say that we're trying to solve. They are the ones who are probably going to be coming up with the solutions.
Charlotte Kahn and Joan Fitzgerald, we've got some callers who want to get in this conversation. We're talking about a new report from the Boston Foundation about the city's relatively healthy economy with a troubling and growing income gap, among other challenges that could seriously threaten future prosperity. Give us a call, 800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Wareham. Hi, Dave.
Hi, good afternoon, and thank you for taking my call.
Happy to do it.
You know, one of the things that I was thinking about and listening to your very prolific speakers here, as an educator myself, I'm a technology teacher in a high school. I think one of the main problems that we're seeing is that a lot of our young people do not have relevant skill sets in which to apply to, a real-world experience. And I think that possibly, creating some sort of partnership, almost like an internship or a cooperative program on the high school level, will help bring these students up too far so that they can gain some relevant real-world experience and apply those skill sets. Now, these kids have a lot of technological experience in interfacing with a lot of the, autonomous gadgets and technology that they carry around with them. I wanted to know what your thoughts were on that.
Dave, thanks for that. Let me put that to Joan Fitzgerald. What do you think about Dave? It sounds like he's almost talking about apprenticeship or that kind of thing.
Well, this experiential education, of course, is what Northeastern University is all about, and it's very, very effective, and I think he's absolutely right about the need to do this at the high school level, and it could be apprenticeships, it could be co-ops. A friend of mine in Chicago, Dan Swinney, is running Austin Polytechnic Academy, where he's taking what was one of the worst high schools in the city and doing just that. It's a pre-engineering curriculum, and they have more than 100 employers involved in placing those students. If I may just add one other element to that, I think there's a great need to, Charlotte was talking about innovation and kind of, we're doing fine with those of us who can afford to go to private schools and so forth in the area, but there's a lot of kids that are just left out of this whole innovation cycle. So looking at the report, some of the careers that you talked about were growing: bioinformatician, advanced robotics, digital media specialist. I know about these only because Northeastern has master's programs in these areas. But if you were to go into a high school or a junior high school in the Boston Public Schools, nobody would even know what these words meant.
So again, getting back to that point you were making earlier about really starting earlier in the K-12 system and really figuring out a link to from the K-12 system to these jobs that are available and needed to be filled. Right?
And so some kind of co-op, apprenticeship, exposure to just the vast array of careers that are going to be very important in the future.
Let's see if we can get another call in. Nick is calling from Needham. Hi, Nick. You're on the air.
Yes, hello. Thanks very much for taking my call. I agree that we have, consistent with the conversation that's taken place, we have very important and prolific large four-year colleges and institutions in Massachusetts, and they do their job wonderfully on a global basis as well. But we do also have, and I think they need a little more publicity and a little more exposure to the kids from Boston Public Schools and others, schools that are training students in some of these mid-level, kind of mid-technology programs. I'm a lifelong resident of Boston until just recently. I had never heard of the Ben Franklin Institute of Technology in Boston. This is a school that's been there for 100 years, which is educating kids, all kinds of kids, in those mid-level, mid-technology type jobs.
So, Nick, it sounds like you're saying these institutions are there. We just need to sort of get the word out a little more aggressively. Yeah, go ahead, Nick.
Institution I didn't even know existed. And I spent an afternoon there learning about what their programs were and how, for a lot of kids, higher education means Shakespeare, more writing, sitting in chairs. And there are institutions out there like Ben Franklin that are finding those kids who are ready, willing, and able to learn.
We got it, Nick, and our time is fast running out, so I'm going to cut you off there, but thank you for the call. Charlotte Kahn, maybe one sort of final closing thought about the report and about Nick's point here about just there are facilities out there, there are resources out there. Word is just getting the word out.
Well, I would actually, with your permission, like to just talk about something else very quickly, which is the cover of our report, which is a light bulb, and it's designed with words that of innovations that stem from Boston. And on the inside cover, we talk about a man who really helped Thomas Edison invent the light bulb. He was the son of slaves, Lewis Latimer. He was given some opportunity and allowed to participate as an inventor, and he actually invented the filament that enabled the light bulb to be mass-produced.
Sure.
and utilized. Without people like that, we wouldn't have our innovation economy. We're talking about finding the Lewis Latimers of today and tomorrow.
Well,
among people who now don't have opportunity.
Well, it's a great challenge, Charlotte Kahn. It's laid out very well in your report from the Boston Foundation, the Boston Indicators Project at the Boston Foundation. Thank you very much. We appreciate it. And Joan Fitzgerald, Director of Northeastern University's Law and Public Policy Program. Thank you as well. I'm Anthony Brooks. Stay with us. There's more to come. This is Radio Boston.